cross-chain space is going to be a massive market, and we need to build the most efficient and most secure solution. High-performance narrative will be really huge, and that comes not only to like blockchain ecosystems, but cross-chain infrastructures as well. And that's why like, high-performance is one of our goals or focus areas in DeepBridge as well.
Before we get moving on today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself, my co-host, or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in the episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or any other advice. Okay, let's jump into the episode. All right, everyone, welcome back to an episode of Lightspeed. We are joined today by Alex, the co-founder of DeepBridge, an intent-centric bridge that is currently doing over 120 million in weekly volume. So, Alex, you guys are crushing it, man. Thanks a ton for hopping on the show today. We got a really exciting kind of question list lined up for you today, covering intents, what the hell they are, and the tech behind it, and how you guys are powering kind of this new age of interoperability throughout the ecosystem. So, maybe a good jumping off point here will be, you know, you guys have been around since the early days, and early days being like a loose term here in the crypto industry, but 2021, man. So you've seen a lot. And I really want to get your take on sort of how the interoperability space specifically has kind of like evolved or developed over the past few years.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, hello, everyone. And hi, Dan. Thanks. Thanks a lot for hosting me today. I'm Alex. I'm a co-founder at DeepBridge. We are building the high-performance cross-chain infrastructure. And the reason why we started to build DeepBridge is because we needed to solve the cross-chain problem for ourselves, right? Before building DeepBridge, we had a blockchain development company, and with another co-founder back in like 2020, we built MEV strategies, and we were like among the first to do a cross-chain arbitrage between Ethereum and BNB chain, right? And the only way to balance liquidity was using the centralized exchanges. And at some point, we just struggled with the efficient rebalancing, right? Because like sometimes exchanges blocked withdrawals, sometimes exchanges suspended accounts, right? Or sometimes just withdrawals were on pause because there was no sufficient liquidity on the hot wallets, right? And that really limited the way we could scale our business. And we realized, okay, that just like the cross-chain space needs to have efficient infrastructure that allows to transfer information and liquidity in a very efficient and non-custodial manner. And that's how the idea of DeepBridge came up. And we just needed to get a trigger to start, you know, implementation and build some POC, proof of concept. And the trigger was the hackathon. Like in April 2021, we participated in the Chainlink Global Hackathon just to have some fun, you know, and to build the concept of the idea that we had in mind. And yeah, eventually we won the hackathon, got the first place among like 150 projects worldwide, got a ton of interest from different VCs and partners. And we realized that like cross-chain space is going to be a massive market, and we need to build the most efficient and most secure solution. And that's where, that's when our mission started. And when we built DeepBridge, we realized that like the foundation of the cross-chain interoperability is a messenger, right? There is the need to transfer information in a decentralized fashion. But at the same time, like messaging itself is not enough. The like everyone, the users and DeFi protocols as well, they first of all need to transfer liquidity or value between chains. And you cannot build the value transfer layer without having efficient messaging. That's why, like from the very beginning, DeepBridge was the cross-chain messaging infrastructure, and cross-chain transfer, like value transfers, was one of the first utilities, right? One of the first apps built on top of DeepBridge. And like in the very first version, we used kind of classical synchronous approach where we had liquidity pools in different chains. And when user makes the transfer, he just like deposits liquidity into the pool in one chain and then receives liquidity or like gets the transfer settles from the pool on another chain. And we quickly realized that this approach is not scalable. Like liquidity pool is always going to be a massive bottleneck. And that's a bottleneck in terms of security, scalability, and capital efficiency. Because like in order to have liquidity, protocols or bridges have to attract it somehow and retain. right? So that means that there should be some incentive or the interest that is continuously paid for liquidity providers. But the problem here is that like cross-chain transfers are discrete, right? Like today, you can have a ton of volume due to market volatility, and tomorrow there will be like very, very low volume because like no one wants to breach into like in that specific direction. But interest have to be paid like continuously in time. That's why there is no way to have like capital efficient or profitable infrastructure. The second problem here is the security, right? Because whenever you have a ton of TVL, that creates massive honeypots for hackers. And that's a big incentive, you know, to exploit the protocol and infrastructure. And that's probably one of the reasons why we've seen so many hacks in the cross-chain space. And bridges are like target number one for like Lazarus Group and all the malicious actors. So security is another like big concern. And scalability as well. Because like whenever you have a pool, you got to have some sort of AMM model, like AMM curve for the price discovery. And that basically means slippage. Because if you have some intermediary asset, that asset have to be swapped into the native asset, and there is always price impact. So users never know how much of asset they will receive on the destination chain. That's why bridging is an unpredictable process in terms of the price. Like the best thing that users can do is just like to specify slippage tolerance. And the last problem is the scalability in general, because let's say, if there is only $1 million of liquidity in the pool and you want to make like $2 million transfer, you simply cannot do that, right? So you're very limited. And the problem here is because like it arises because classical approach, like, or like most of the bridges, you know, they try to solve asset custody and bridging, like value bridging simultaneously. So they custodied assets across all the chains, and they enable trading through the pools. And I think that in DBridge, we're the first team in the space that tried to differentiate cross-chain asset custody from cross-chain trading. Because like the word bridge itself became like very confusing because like there is custody bridges, like messaging bridges or value transfer bridges. And like people are trying to solve everything in a single, by single solution. When we have like specific solution for every pillar. And that's, I guess, the main differentiator.
My friends, big, big news. Blockworks is hosting Permissionless 3 in Salt Lake City this year. So we're heading west for 3 days starting October 9th. Permissionless is our industry's premier DeFi event that brings together crypto natives from all over the globe. I've personally been the last 2 years and can honestly say that the attendees are incredible. It's people who actually care about crypto. We'll also have more than 200 industry titans speaking at the event. And this includes builders like Lucas Bruder from Jito Labs and Brian Pellegrino from Layer Zero, or investors like Kyle Samani and Joe McCann, and even elected officials like Representative Tom Emmer, who is fighting the good fight in Washington. And it's narrative season, so we're going to be covering the 7 hottest themes in crypto. This includes things like modularity and restaking, or Bitcoin and L2s, and even AI and crypto. The goal is to keep you up to speed on major developments in the industry. Ticket prices will be structurally increasing over time, so get your ticket today. For my Lightspeed family, I got you. We're going to use code LIGHTSPEED10 in all caps, no space, for 10% off your ticket. All right, everyone. I look forward to seeing you at Permissionless 3, and let's get back to the show. And so as a bridge provider or messaging platform, you know, you connect to a lot of chains and you see a lot of different architectural designs of those chains, right? And maybe if you had a spectrum of like decentralization to performance, you'd have like Ethereum on the decentralization end, wants to push execution off to its L2s. And for that reason, it's like prioritizing the, you know, the solo staker, the at-home staker versus pushing further out into the performance end of the spectrum. You know, you'll come across like a Solana or even further out, maybe an Aptos or a Sui. I'm curious where you think like the ideal trade-off lies. And of course, like there are trade-offs here, right? Like, but I'm curious where you see the industry moving as we go forward. Is it more towards the decentralization end, or is it more towards the performance end of that spectrum?
Yeah, I think that like every chain will have a trade-off, right? It just depends on like what niche every single ecosystem is trying to target. Because Ethereum is obviously the most secure, the most decentralized blockchain ecosystem. But the problem here is that like not everyone can afford using Ethereum. Like small users are not willing to pay, they cannot afford like paying $70 in gas for one transaction. right? And sometimes you send transaction, and then you find out that transaction is reverted, but you still got gas deducted from your wallet balance, right? That's why Ethereum is not like suitable for the smaller like retail users, but more for institutional investors or institutional players who need to have like maximum security guarantees. From another side, we have Solana, right, which is a high performance infrastructure. And Solana is very, very cheap, very scalable. And at the same time, it's decentralized enough, you know, to make bigger investor to be comfortable with the security model as well. So in DBridge in general, we are like very bullish on the high performance infrastructures, you know, because that's the type of infrastructure that we are building, because so far DBridge is the fastest bridge on the market, right? And our motto says that DeFi does not wait. Like our users are those who don't want to wait for like 20 or 30 minutes for the transfer of their assets between chains, right? And I think that this kind of thesis is applicable for Solana and like high performance chains as well, because in general, like the main advantage of DeFi is like 24/7 accessibility, transparency, and non-custodial control over the funds. That's why in my personal opinion, I think that like the narrative will be shifting toward like high performance chains. And I think that like in DBridge, we did a really great job when we started to build on Solana, because we are like Solana native projects, you know, before DBridge launched on mainnet in 2022, we started to build smart contracts and like the infrastructure for Solana ecosystem. It's just like after like securing our first round and receiving a small grant from Solana Foundation, we realized like, or we started to think like, okay, guys, like what should be the first non-EVM chain that DBridge will support? And that was like almost 3 years ago. And we just like the narrative, you know, and overall ecosystem that was built on Solana. And yeah, we thought like, okay, let's build up the whole Brass team within DBridge, you know, and start building. And it took us almost 2 years to get from the point like where we started until the point we released on production. So yeah, we basically released just in June 2023, and in November last year, like after Solana breakpoint, just like Solana was on fire, right? Everyone realized that like speed, security, and finality are those qualities that like retail users appreciate. And I think that what people really like, the best finality to decentralization ratio that Solana has. Because like you have quick finality on layer twos as well, like Arbitrum, Optimism. But the problem there is that sequencer is centralized for now, right? And they still have yet to become decentralized or be governed by the community. And Solana is decentralized already, right? It got like thousands of nodes. And the finality is very quick because like the transaction is getting processed within seconds or sometimes sub-seconds, depending on the kind of confirmation level that you expect as a user. So yeah, and that's why Solana becomes very, you know, convenient for many broader use cases, such as payments. It's like when you pay by your credit card, you're not waiting for like 20 seconds, right? You just like want to tap and get the product that you're buying. Same with the on-chain transactions. Like if you're paying for something or just like use crypto to purchase the item in the online store, you cannot wait. You just like want to process transaction and move on. And that's why I think that like high performance narrative will be really huge, and that comes not only to like blockchain ecosystems but cross chain infrastructures as well. And that's why high performance is one of our goals or focus areas in DBridge as well.
Speed kills. There's no doubt about it. And I love your motto that you know, DeFi doesn't wait. I think that's becoming proven exceedingly true in the recent years. And I also like in the first response, you kind of talked about your transition away from that liquidity model, given those key problems, mostly centered around like scalability of the model and the need for liquidity, into more of like this intent centric model. And intents have become like this big sexy word, and they kind of mean everything. Which is, but I want you to explain to us, you know, what does the intent-centric bridging model look like? Like, what is the what is happening behind the scenes, and what does it look like to the user?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, intent-based model is the first that enables asynchronous paradigm, right? Because like, whenever liquidity pool is used, as we've discussed, there is like MM curve, and the price discovery happens through that curve. So price discovery happens in the smart contract. That's why users need to specify slippage tolerance parameter. In the intent-based approach, user controls execution. So user controls the price as well. It's very simple. Like, when we create the intent, we're just providing some reward for the action that we want to get done. So we can say, okay, guys, I'm giving 100 USDC on Polygon to anyone who will give me 99 USDC on Solana. So we basically provide one USDC incentive or spread to anyone who will fulfill our intent. And in this case, like, basic intent is just a limit order, and we can specify any price, right? If intent is not profitable, let's say we are saying like, we are giving $100 to anyone who will give us $1,000. Obviously, no one will be interested to fulfill our intent, and we'll have to cancel it. But if intent is profitable, then we kind of create MEV opportunity, right? We incentivize the entire market to execute this opportunity and get the action done. And the basic intent is just a limit order, but like, the word itself, like the word intent, assumes more sophisticated actions. So we can say, look, guys, I'm giving 100 USDC to anyone who will get 95 USDC to be deployed to my Camino account on Solana, or I'm giving like 50 USDC on Polygon to anyone who will open a long position, like Sol long position on Flash Trade Protocol on Solana. So intents can be very complicated, right? And they're fulfilled by professional market makers or solvers. And the beauty of this approach is that solvers take on all the risks, right? That comes to risks of transaction finality, risks of transaction reorgs, risks of inventory management and asset custody. So for users, like in this case, the bridging operation just looks like a trade on centralized exchange because it's very fast. Like, when intent is created, there is no cross-chain communication. So just like all the solvers or market maker, they see directly from the chain that there is a new intent created. They immediately evaluate its profitability. And if it's profitable, they compete on like who is the first to execute that action on the destination chain. So the beauty of this approach is that there is no messaging involved here directly, because messaging is slow, right? It requires like guaranteed finality normally. It requires to pass through validation layer on the bridging side. And in our case, there is no messaging before the intent is executed, but messaging itself is used by market makers to unlock liquidity on the source chain after intent is executed. So the model works in a way that they provide liquidity upfront, or like they execute the action intent upfront, and then they can trigger a cross-chain message that is sent to the source chain to unlock liquidity that user provided, right? So in this design, or in this case, like, market makers also bear take on any risks of the cross-chain messaging as well. Let's say risk of collusion of validators, or risk of the any problems with the messaging validation layer. So yeah, and for user, we can achieve like the best possible user experience. It's just like any intent is getting settled in a matter of seconds. And the model is also very scalable, right? Because we are not limited in terms of liquidity. Like, user can create $5 million trade from one chain to another. And in order to get this trade fulfilled, there should be just market makers who have decent liquidity on their balance sheet and who can fulfill that intent. So yeah, and there is nothing to hack, because like, there is no liquidity that is getting continuously locked in the smart contract, because like, all the solvers or market makers, they just hold liquidity directly on their wallets, on their balance, and they control the custody over that liquidity. And just like, when there is a profitable intent, they provide that liquidity just in time. So they fulfill intent and then immediately unlock liquidity on the source chain. So yeah, that's basically how the model works.
So to me, it sounds like the takeaway here is you're abstracting away all the complexity from the user. So the user gets this very seamless experience where they say, hey, here's the action that I intend to take in the case of, in the, you know, the take of a cross chain swap is probably the easiest to reason through. You know, you're like, I have ETH on Ethereum mainnet and I want SOL on Solana, right? And that's kind of the intent the user expresses. And then the complexity is kind of shoved onto the market makers, solvers, builders, fillers, whatever you want to call them. It's the same group of people, sophisticated actors that fulfill the action behind the scenes. And so those sophisticated actors play a very key role in making this happen. And to me, it would seem like, you know, if I was launching a intent-based protocol, onboarding them and integrating them into my system would be like P1 for me, right? That like, if you can't achieve that, then you got nobody filling the orders. How hard is it to get them on board? Because like, obviously there's an incentive here with them taking a cut of the transfer, but I'm just curious, like getting them on board, what is the big challenge there?
Yeah, I would say bootstrapping the intent infrastructure is like really big challenge, you know, because like when we built intent-based model, you know, we reached out to different market makers. We said, look, guys, we build this model. We need like liquidity providers or solvers who can like fulfill intent. And big market makers were not really interested because like they used to operate, you know, on the centralized exchanges as well. And they're interested only if there is like multi-million dollar opportunity that is easy to grab. And if that requires some sort of development or maintenance, it makes them difficult to get incentivized. So what we did, we built the first solver ourselves, right? We were the first like to start fulfilling intents, and we just open sourced the intent script. We call it like DLM taker script. It's on our GitHub repository. And as volume started to grow on DBridge, we started to see some addresses that started to front run us, right? Some guys took our script, optimized the code or infrastructure, they just became faster. And then we started to observe like more and more MEV searchers and like on-chain addresses join the competition. Because like when volumes are growing, they're getting more and more incentive to kind of optimize for the speed. And eventually we got the group of addresses, and we even didn't know who they are. You know, they never reached out to us, and we just saw that they're very fast and they're very sophisticated because like they have very deep skills in terms of like managing infrastructure, optimizing RPCs and stuff like that. So, and we were happy to see that because like in DBridge, our goal is very simple. We want to get users trade fulfilled as soon as possible, right? And what important in the intent-based approaches is to have like open competition so that anyone can join it, right? So you don't give any like specific preferences to specific parties, but you create an open market where anyone can compete. And the only problem we had left to solve is like institutional liquidity, because if the trade is not too big, like it was fulfilled by this like MEV searchers, but we start to receive cases when someone was like trading $2 million or $1 million. You know, and obviously to fulfill this kind of intent, you need to have like $1 million of liquidity on the balance sheet. And we started to brainstorm, like, how should we solve the problem of the institutional liquidity? And we had a couple of ideas, you know. The first one was like to lend or like to borrow liquidity from some bigger liquidity provider. But the problem with this approach is that like to borrow liquidity, you need to post collateral. But if you have collateral, you don't need liquidity. So it's sort of vicious circle. And eventually we started to talk to Rockaway, to the fund from Czech Republic. And they're also like, they have a liquid, branch that is in charge of liquidity management. And, they suggested an idea. They said like, okay, guys, like find a way where you can like use liquidity without having control or like custody over that liquidity. And we've realized that we can build like very interesting setup where that liquidity is sitting on like MPC wallet that is under control of Rockaway, but like market makers or solvers of DBridge can just like propose transactions to that MPC wallet that are getting validated by Rockaway and then automatically broadcast. So yeah, we got like the first concept of this setup, started to work together. The MPC infrastructure was provided by 4DeFi. The MPC wallet that is built by guys from Israel, and everything like puzzle started to, you know, getting in place, like all the pieces. And yeah, like Rockaway really helped us out on the market making or like solving fronts. And it was quite a unique case because like the main like fund managers from Rockaway, they're coming from the classical TradFi background. And they were very excited because like this kind of setup would never be possible in TradFi, where you can manage liquidity without having like control over that liquidity and even without posing collateral. And that becomes possible only because of the DeFi infrastructure, right? Because like everything is on chain and like one party can control the custody and like other parties can propose transactions. So it's quite interesting. That allows us to enable institutional grade liquidity. So now if there is like big trade coming, we have this MPC setup, which is slower, but Rockaway, the fund that can like provide liquidity to get those like very complex or like very big intents to be fulfilled as well. So yeah, that's like part of the story on how the Solvers network was bootstrapped on Debridge.
Do you think there'll be like an increasing DeFi flipping CeFi narrative there, just because that revelation that Rockaway kind of had exists only on blockchain rails? And so I'm curious, just to, you know, it sounds like you have a pretty good inside view of how this, you know, a single fund, sample size of one here, but how they viewed this, and if you think that there'll be a kind of a common theme as crypto becomes, you know, the adoption of crypto increases through time.
Yeah, I think that classical markets will inevitably move on chain, just because like blockchain infrastructure and DeFi in general provides transparency, predictability, and you know, everyone has access to data. So let's say if you take a loan, you don't need to trust like some documents. You can just look at the on-chain balances, and everyone has equal access to information, right? And transparency. And like markets, like with the blockchain infra, markets can work 24/7. So you're not limited in terms of like operation hours. And that's why I also believe that like high performance infrastructure will play a crucial role here, because in order to have efficient markets, we need to have like the minimal latency. And that's why blockchain ecosystems like Solana will have big market share in terms of enabling these rails for classical TradFi world to move toward the decentralized infrastructure. And at the same time, like blockchain also provides the way to build permission systems. So let's say JP Morgan or some company will want to have their own infrastructure, they can just run the fork, right, like SVM or EVM, and they will control the validation layer and they will control RPCs. At the same time, they can use bridges like Debridge, you know, to enable interconnection between like permission blockchain ecosystems with permissionless world to enable efficient liquidity transfers between both.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. Sorry, I want to jump back to the solver side of things here. So, you know, you mentioned that they have to take balance sheet risk. And if you want to fulfill this intent, you have to have the asset to actually fulfill the intent. And you've built a system where you actually have to prove that the intent has indeed been fulfilled. And so, I guess the point there being you'd need to take balance sheet risk. So what does this look like? You know, let's say I was on Ethereum mainnet with ETH and I was like, whiff, this meme coin on Sol has really got my attention. I want to go buy some of that. How does that work in the intent-based model? I think you guys had a recent integration with Jito that kind of you know, plays a key role here.
Yeah, that's a good question. So whenever you create intent, right, you provide the reward or the asset that you give on the source chain, and you specify what asset or like token address you want to receive on the destination chain. And let's say in your example, you want to receive some meme coin. And the problem here is that like solvers or market makers, they most likely don't have that meme coin on their balance sheet. So they need to find the most efficient route to swap from the asset that they have on the balance sheet into the asset that user wants to receive within that specific intent, right? And normally market makers hold the most liquid assets like USDC and ETH. And in case of Solana, that likely will be USDC. And they see the intent and they need to swap from that USDC to the meme coin. So the most efficient way to do that is like by aggregating on-chain liquidity. So all the solvers are using Jupyter API to find the best route for the swap. So what they do, they need to, in a single transaction, they need to make a swap plus fulfillment of the intent, right? And after fulfillment, they will unlock liquidity on the Ethereum side, USDC, and earn the small spread. And the problem here, like on Solana, that transactions are limited in terms of the maximal transaction size, right? That's why solvers would have to, like if the swap is complex on Jupiter, if it has like many legs, solvers would have to do swap and then fulfillment. And that's not atomic, right? And there can be a risk that they do the swap into this meme coin, then intent is already fulfilled by someone else. So we really needed to solve the challenge that would allow solvers or market makers to fit everything in a single transaction. And that's where Jito bundles helped out, because that, like, Jito infrastructure allowed us to bundle everything together and make that interaction to be atomic. So if swap is failed or like fulfillment of the intent is failed, the whole bundle is reverted. So thanks to Jito and this integration, like with Jupiter plus Jito, we managed to provide very reliable way for market makers to stay delta neutral and avoid that volatility risks of the long tail assets.
Very interesting. That makes a lot of sense, that if you have like the atomicity and you can make these swaps and guaranteed in the same block, then you can still hold the, you know, that one single asset that you're okay with taking price risk to, that is a liquid asset and still facilitate these intents. That makes a ton of sense there. One thing I'm curious about is, I don't know if this makes sense, so correct me if this is a silly take here, but so these solvers, fillers, builders, whatever you want to call them, it seems like the largest market of those today is probably Ethereum block builders. And I'm curious to get your thought on A, if you agree with that, and B, if so, that kind of has become, you know, dominated by a very small number of parties. I haven't looked at the MEV data recently, the MEV boost data recently. Tony has built a great dashboard. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. But last I looked, there's like, let's say it's three or four builders that, you know, produce somewhere on the order of 60 to 70 to 80% of Ethereum blocks. Over the long term, what do you think the solver market looks like for DBridge, or maybe just intents more generally? Like, it seems that there would be a kind of a power law and like a couple of firms really being able to dominate the transaction flow here, but I'm curious if you agree with that.
Yeah, I think that there is like a huge misconception and like misunderstanding of the MEV space in general. You know, many people think that this space is very monopolized or like very centralized, but it's not true. So we should think about the MEV space, you know, as about like Formula One race, like why there is no second Max Verstappen. And the answer is simple, like there is no second best, right? He's just like the best at what he does. Same for MEVs, like there are solvers that are doing like very good job. You know, they have like hyper-optimized infrastructure, hyper-optimized code built on Rust. They're just the fastest. And whenever anyone try to compete with them, they fail, because like the same transaction, they always later than the best one. That's why competition is hard, especially if that competition comes to speed, like in DBridge. So like based on the stats that we have in our Explorer, we had around like 300 different wallets that fulfill transactions. So basically 300 solvers, right? But only five or six are getting the biggest market share, with a couple of those are like who are dominating. Just because they're best, you know, and it's very difficult to become faster. So you got to have like the same level of infrastructure or experience as they have. And this is also the reason why there is no, like, you know, Jared from Subway, one of the biggest MEV searchers on Ethereum, just because he's the best, right? He's taking the biggest share of the MEV opportunities and he executes that share. So I guess like we'll still see this kind of dominance, and that is fine, because again, the goal is to get users' trades fulfilled. If you have the accessibility or like the entry to be kind of decentralized for and open for everyone, then you create a fair market, right? And if someone says, look, like this guy is dominating the space is centralized. No, it's not centralized. It's just you cannot build enough efficient solution that are efficient enough to compete with that guy. And for us, like in DeepBridge at this stage, the main kind of factor that we are solving for is the speed, because we are focused on the high performance, right? To provide some alpha, like in the second version of the intent-based infrastructure, we'll have also the price discovery component. Like that will be the second variable added to equation in addition to the speed factor. But still, the space like will be kind of dominated by those who are doing this job, like MEV job or so intense taking job in the best possible way.
That's, I love the F1 comparison there. I guess I got to peg you for a Red Bull fan now. But so let's talk about fees then. So like you mentioned that price discovery piece, right? And you have to imagine that if I'm a user on chain A and I want to go to chain B and I have $100, like I want $100 on chain B, but there needs to be some incentive to make that transaction happen. And today, I think you mentioned it was $1. Like, how do you think about that going forward? And will there be fee compression here? People love to talk about like a race to the bottom in fees, but the reality is Coinbase is still charging 3% on retail trades. So I'm curious how you think about this.
Yeah, so first, you got to provide incentive. That's true. So for example, in DeepBridge, when you quote like the market price, like user can specify an arbitrary price, right? But if he wants to have his intent to be executed instantly, he can query our API and ask, like, what price should I specify to get instant settlement? And our API just lays in 4 bips incentive for the solvers, right? Which is not too big, I would say. And plus 4 bips is a fee that is taken by DeepBridge infrastructure, by DeepBridge smart contracts for settlement, right? And at the end of the day, I think that there will be a way to kind of match intents directly between users and create some like network effects. So let's say if I'm bridging like from Ethereum to Solana and you're bridging from Solana to Ethereum, then we don't need to have market maker or solver, right? And we can preserve those 4 bips to be takers for each other. But again, that is already like kind of hyper optimization that is not needed at this specific moment, because like markets are not that efficient yet, but we are getting there step by step. I think for now, the biggest challenge is like to set up the efficient liquidity rails so that market makers can rebalance liquidity very efficiently. And we had a good example, you know, or like interesting use case with Solana. Like previously, the only way to get liquidity deposited to Solana was through centralized exchanges or through Circle Mint platform, where you can have like an institutional account, you can like deposit USD through the bank, you know, and mint directly on the Solana chain. But that way is like very slow. And it's assumed to, because like Circle Mint is asset custody solution and it's supposed to be used by like institutional players. Like the second alternative was exchanges. You can deposit to, let's say, Binance from Ethereum and then withdraw to Solana. And that's how like many solvers used to rebalance liquidity. But the problem here is that like whenever there is any volatility on the market, exchanges immediately run out of the liquidity on their hot wallets and they immediately suspend withdrawals. So it's like very classical problem that like whenever liquidity is needed, no one have it. And we saw it many times and it's still happening. And I think that what really helped in terms of establishing more efficient liquidity rails is like Circle CCTP, you know, because we started to have kind of non-custodial way to interact with Circle platform to kind of redeem USDC on one chain and like mint USDC on another. The problem here that is still institutional because it's asset custody solution, so it's very slow. You know, it may take like up to 30 minutes to get the USDC transferred, but this is fine because like market makers need to rebalance liquidity only once in a while, right? Like a few times per day, and they're okay to wait like 30 minutes. While for users, the service or the settlement is still instant because like market makers or solvers provide the liquidity upfront. And yeah, as soon as we have this like efficient liquidity rails and like decentralized infrastructure that allows to move liquidity nearly instantly and without slippage. I think that we have like more efficient markets and can enable freedom of movement for like users and these institutional players who need to move fast between different blockchains.
No, that makes sense to me. And what, like, I guess going one step deeper on the idea of bringing global liquidity on chain, like what do you think still needs to happen? Like what key elements are missing? Because it does feel like we're, and to your point, you know, with CCTP Live, the rebalancing side gets easier for these sophisticated actors. But like what pieces are still missing?
I think asset custody is the biggest challenge, right? Because like whenever you need to establish or bootstrap the new ecosystem or the new chain, you first need to have a bridge, right? You need to provide the framework or like let developers and projects to move easily toward your ecosystem or expand there, right? In order to make that happen, you need to have the custody solution that would allow to bring any asset to the ecosystem. And that comes, like, if we talk about like on-chain asset, that comes to like canonical bridges that allows you to lock asset in one chain and mint derivative on the other side in your blockchain. So let's say Arbitrum custody bridge or like Optimism custody bridge are those who are solving this like asset custody challenge. And that is pillar number one. Like, how do we enable decentralized minting of the assets? For real world assets, we got to have asset custody as well. And Circle basically uses this as a good example of the solution that allows you to like provide real USD to the bank account and mint the derivative, the digital like USDC asset on chain. So as soon as custody is solved, any market makers or institutional players, you know, can bring liquidity to the blockchain. The second pillar to solve here is like trading. When asset is already deployed, you want to provide ability for everyone to trade efficiently into this asset. So you need to have cross-chain infrastructure, right, to allow users to bridge liquidity very quickly and seamlessly. And you need to have like solvers or professional market makers who are settling those trades. And as soon as these pillars of interoperability are enabled, we already have some sort of rails that open up gateway for retail users and projects to expand. And yeah, that's what probably will be needed to bring markets on chain.
One more question here around sort of the technical side of this, which is like, where do the trust assumptions lie for the user? Like, if I say, hey, you know, here's my intent, I want to ensure that I have, you know, X amount of dollars when the intent is completed or the limit order is fulfilled, like, where do I need to have, like, where's the trust in the system? And like, does me as the user making this intent have to take any risk on while this is being fulfilled?
So yeah, first group of risks is like the smart contract risk, right? And that is applicable to any DeFi primitive in any project. Whenever you like grant token approval or sign the permit, you kind of rely on the smart contract, right? That's why the audit practices, you know, and like overall security is super important. And for example, in DeepBridge, like we treat security very seriously. That's why we are like one of the only bridges that never had security problems or discovered vulnerabilities. And we've been super proud, you know, to maintain this high bar of security standards in the cross-chain space. So security smart contracts risk is the one, the first group. The second one is the validation, right? With classical bridges, when there are like liquidity pools, users are those who send a message cross-chain. So they need to trust that validators of the messaging layer will not collude and forge the message. And message transfer can be slow. Like for some chains, it can take like 25 minutes, let's say, for messages initiated from Polygon. And that's why, like for users, bridging is some sort of black box. So you send transaction, your funds are transferred from your wallet, and now you're like nervously waiting for like 30 minutes until they will appear on the destination chain. And sometimes they don't appear, and then you have to reach out to the support, you know, in Discord and like ask, where is my funds? So in DeepBridge, we kind of shifted that paradigm, right? With the intent-based approach, we moved on all these risks from users to professional market makers. Because like you create a trade, you create intent, and it's getting fulfilled in seconds. So you don't need to nervously wait because you know that like the funds are going to appear on your wallet in a matter of seconds. And moreover, you always know that your funds will never get stuck. Because in the worst case scenario, if like there is no taker or solver that fulfilled your action or intent, you can cancel it by initiating the cross-chain message that is sent from the destination chain back to source chain. And you can cancel at any moment before it's fulfilled. So you control the execution flow. And that's why like DeepReach users are very, you know, excited because like first trades are very fast. But even if in some rare case scenario or in case you create a limit order, if it's not fulfilled, you control it, right? You can cancel. So there is no like magic or black box. You always keep custody over your own funds. And that's why probably like DeepReach has like zero marketing budgets, you know, because like our product is our marketing. Like people get impressed by this like fast execution and they just like organically spread the word. But like in terms of the trust assumptions, most of the risks are moved to market makers. So they bear a bunch of risks. First, that transaction may get reorked on the source chain, right, or like reverted for some reason. Second, they use messaging. Like after intents are fulfilled, they trigger a cross-chain message that is sent by the smart contract on the destination chain to the smart contract on the source chain that kind of relays this proof of fulfillment of the intent. And with messaging, like with any messaging infrastructure, there is a risk that like validators may collude, right, and forge the message. But at the same time, with this like intent-based approach, the risk is way lower because like the liquidity that is locked is not a huge liquidity pool. It's just like the amount of transfers that are being settled at this specific moment. So instead of like $100 million incentive, the whole transfer, like the whole bandwidth is way lower. That makes the system to be more secure and like validators don't have any incentive, you know, to collude. And moreover, like as a next step, it's also important to introduce financial guarantees so that validators of the bridges are not just like validating or they're not just picked by governance, but they also pose slashable financial guarantees. So if they do something wrong, the governance will slash them and reimburse to those users or market makers who had a loss due to misbehavior of validators. So yeah, that's how we see it. And of course, like there is also the set of long-tail risks, such as custody risks, right, of the blockchain ecosystem. Because like market makers hold assets on Arbitrum, that means that they rely on the Arbitrum sequencer and the Arbitrum custody bridge. If they use CCTP, they kind of bear the risk that like Circle may not attest or like sign the transfer initiated through CCTP. Or if you hold USDC, you rely on the Circle in general. So yeah, just like the whole kind of set of risks. But I think it's quite important, you know, to abstract those risks or move from like regular users who don't understand those risks and they have no chance to manage those to professional actors who are like experienced in the risk management space.
Right. Again, there comes back up where, you know, you're just kind of offloading the complexity away from the user and onto someone who is intentionally taking that complexity on being the sophisticated actor. I think broadly that idea makes a ton of sense, given just how complex a lot of this industry is. But I wanted to just take a second swing there on so the validator piece that you mentioned. What is like the validator set look like today, specifically that you're referring to? And how do you intend to kind of develop going forward?
Yeah, so right now we don't have token yet in DeepReach, right? So our team governed the protocol and we bootstrapped the set of validators based on the performance of validators and people who participate in our test, right? We just picked 11 best validators, like looking at their performance, reliability, etc. So validation layer in general is like one of the most important verticals in terms of like how cross-chain messaging bridges should be evaluated, right? So we should look at number of validators, like their financial guarantees and like how the validation is built. I think that we've taken quite a unique approach here. So in DoBridge, we don't have any blockchain or intermediary network. Our validators don't even talk or communicate with each other. Built validation in a way that like validators just listen to events, like messages that are initiated through DoBridge smart contracts, and then they sign the unique hash of the message with their private key and store signature into Arweave, into the decentralized storage. And that allows anyone who has access to signatures to deliver or execute message on the destination chain. And with this kind of design, we have like three big advantages. First, security, because like validators never expose their IP addresses. They never talk to each other. So we never know where like validators host their validation node. Second is a gas efficiency, because like signing cryptographic signature is a very simple operation, right? So validators just like sign the hash and make it public through Arweave. And that's it. That's why the infrastructure is also very gas efficient, because like validators don't bear any costs. They don't broadcast any transactions. They just expose the signatures for each message. And here, like, it's important to understand like how validators are elected and what financial guarantees they will bear. So for now, we just picked 11 validators ourselves. But the idea that as soon as we have token and like pass control over the infrastructure to decentralized governance, governance will be able to decide like how many validators infrastructure should have, and at the same time, like who should be validators participating in the infrastructure. And I think that what will be important is like how much collateral validators are willing to provide, because like we have these delegated staking and slashing modules that we will deploy after governance is getting decentralized. And that module allows anyone to stake liquidity for validators, right? And share the risk of validators' misbehavior or collusion, but at the same time get rewarded for taking on that risk. So let's say I know that like Nod's guardians are like very professional in terms of infrastructure management, and are willing to stake like, I don't know, $200,000 for these validators to participate in the reward distribution mechanism and helping to secure the infrastructure. But at the same time, if Nod's guardians will do something wrong, they will get slashed by governance, and I have a chance like to lose my collateral, because it will be used to reimburse those who had a loss. So with this kind of approach, we don't really need to chase the maximal number of validators, but we need to try and maximize their slashable collateral, their financial guarantees. And that's sort of the vector that we are taking in DoBridge, because right now we have 11 validators. We think that it's sufficient, but of course, like this number can always can be increased. But what is really important is like to increase the guaranteed.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that that's definitely one of the more important verticals, and it'll be exciting to watch that grow as time goes on. But Alex, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a fantastic discussion. Broadly, I was like a little bit iffy on the whole world of intents, but you've pilled me, man. I'm all in. So thanks again for coming on, man. And we'll throw some links in the show notes to DoBridge and your Twitter as well. But cheers, man. It's been fantastic.
Cheers. Yeah, I appreciate hosting me today. And it's always great, you know, to talk to people who understand this space. And you guys are doing a great job on the research side of things. So, yeah, big shout out.
Thank you. Much appreciate that, man. Well, all the best. Cheers.